Session number 6104, real time.
Colonel Truscott, take two.
And your job in life is to carry out your commitment and your normal daily tasks. You really didn't think about the future at all.
When did
people begin to see the Japanese troops in the new territory, on the edge of the new territory? Was that quite a long time before they actually came into Hong Kong?
1938 was the Japanese invasion of southern China, and we used to go up there on a Sunday or a Saturday weekend and have a look across the border and see them marching along throughout the other side of a valley or something like that. They'd normally have they'd used a lot of coolie labour, refugee labour, and you'd see a whole column marching along a hillside carrying ammunition boxes and things like that, with a couple of Japanese in the front, a couple of Japanese in, to the rear. We used to watch the Japanese activities there. Plus, of course, there were at two border posts. One was Lai Chi Kok, and the other one was Lo Wu. Those were the two border posts where you could walk up within a few feet and actually look at the Japanese.
And in spite of that, it was still considered that the attack would come from the sea when it came?
No. Then I think General Grasset was the GOC, and General Grasset's... I'm not aware really of what the policies were of the High Command, but it was gradually, I think, from 1938 onwards... And policy does take time to change. From 1938 onwards, it was envisaged that the attack would be land-borne invasion. But nevertheless, we were complete as far as the sea was concerned. And from 38 onwards, our attention was turned to stopping a land-borne invasion. And indeed, that was my reason for being in Hong Kong, to form part of then the mobile signal section.
Did you always have enough equipment to do what you needed to do?
Not really. It was old equipment. We hadn't got the complete modern equipment that you have today. All the manufacturers behind you as you have today. Then we had the SRD, Signal Research and Experimental Establishment, at Christchurch. They would approve sets for use with Royal Signals. But no, you didn't have the vast amount of equipment that you have today.
What sort of areas did you feel particularly badly equipped in? Can you specify any sort of particular example of a part that you needed but couldn't get? Or something like that?
For the sets that you had your spares and so on, but it was the range, the frequencies and so on. They were the sets of the day.
Can you tell me about the outbreak of hostilities itself? What were you doing at the time?
I was then in Sham Shui Po the night before, on the 7th of December, and had been there in Sham Shui Po, which was the depot of the barracks of the Middlesex Regiment in Kowloon. And I'd been there for quite a while, really. We were routing all the cables from Kowloon into the new territories, and our job was to link up all the pillboxes, because now the concept was now land-borne invasion, and so they hurriedly put up a fixed line of defence or two fixed lines of defence, and our job was then to link these pillboxes and make a command or brigade headquarters, and our job was to link them, put the cables out and so on, and that was the actual job I was doing when on the Sunday that or rather the Sunday we were confined to barracks, that was the 7th, on the 8th of December, it was positive. In other words, there were Japanese bombers in the sky, Japanese aircraft raiding Hong Kong.
So what sort of warning did you have?
No warning at all. Fortunately, we, in Hong Kong, we'd been on a 24-hour standby prior to that, a Red Star standby, and we're at our battle stations, everyone was where they should be, and nothing happened that night. The following morning, on the Monday morning, the 8th, the Japanese bombers came over, strafed various targets. Indeed, the barracks I was in was strafed. And before I went to work that day, I used to go to work at the start of the clock. And before that, they'd struck. And indeed, my job was to, one of the tasks I did was to go and try and recover some of the bodies and indeed injured of the bombing that had occurred on the barracks.
Was that when the married quarters were
attacked? That's right, yes. It's called the Jubilee Building, and soldiers were living in the, it had been turned to a soldier's quarter, soldier area, because the families had been evacuated from Hong Kong some nine months previously, fortunately.
What did you find when you went in there?
Dead bodies around in one particular thing. It's very macabre. I saw a Chinese houseboy laying in a bath that was completely, well, it was just red blood, and he'd had his leg shot off, and there he was just laying, bleeding so freely, and so on. We got him out, we put a tourniquet around his, around the top part of his thigh, and called the ambulance and got him away. And indeed, one of the Canadian sergeants was killed there. The Canadian regiments, two of them, had arrived some 3 weeks in Hong Kong before the actual day of war started.
When the Canadian regiments arrived, you must have felt pretty sure that you were on the verge of hostilities, I suppose.
Well, no, it was very nice that they'd come. In other words, this was our reinforcement and we could hold out that much longer. It was a backup. And we were delighted that they'd arrived. I wasn't to know till later that some of their weapons, vehicles and ammunition didn't arrive with them, so they were without weapons.
And were they trained to a very high standard, do you think?
They were trained, I would think, to a good standard, but they had a difficult job ahead of them. We knew the terrain. We were accustomed to the climate. We knew the Chinese, and so on. So they were miles away from home. They were wartime, most of them were wartime soldiers. They probably weren't very keen on soldiering anyway, but had been thrust into it. So I wouldn't want to have been a Canadian soldier for anything, really.
Did you have much contact with them, or you just saw them in the distance?
Yes, we had contact with them, liaison contact. But then when the war started, there's a great lot of contact with them.
How much of your time was taken up by going around to buildings that had been strafed and helping the wounded?
Well, that was happening all the time because it was a close infighting war. My job, I was basically on the day war started, I was in Kowloon, and 4 days after that I left Kowloon for the simple reason that the Japanese had made such shots that we had to get out rather quickly and was detailed to move out. We had to leave our pillboxes and so on.
And what day was that?
That was day four, if you like. And I then boarded a Umati ferry with a vehicle and some of my crew, some of my detachment, and we headed for Hong Kong. I was then posted to a the ridge of Hong Kong and Wong Lu Chong Gap, where it was my job then to maintain communications that came up from battle headquarters and indeed keep the top of the island communications going, because the cables came up from battle headquarters to the top of the mountains and then spread out right and left to Fort Stanley, Fort Collins and David, and Fort Davis Fort and so on. It was my job to keep those communications going.
So during the 4 days before you evacuated Kowloon, you were attending the sick and helping?
No. I was out in the new territories, still linking the pillboxes. And the advance of the Japanese was so rapid that came to a halt, and I was told to about turn and make for the ferry and get across to the island. In other words, the evacuation of Kowloon had commenced.
Did that strike at your morale when you realised that you'd so quickly been pushed back to the island?
It does. Yes, it did.
How long did you spend attending to the communications on Hong Kong Island itself?
Until the surrender, and the surrender came on Christmas Day, 1941. And I maintained my position at that point, repairing bombed cables and so on, until finally we ourselves were pushed back from Wong Lu Chong Gap to a second and third position. We finally finished at Victoria Peak, which is the topmost part of the island, by the Peak Tram. We couldn't go any further. There was nowhere else to go. And we heard from one of our officers that the general, and indeed the governor, had agreed to surrender terms.
What sort of pressure were you under during the period of doing the repairs?
Well, you were being strafed all the time from Hong Kong, from Kowloon, because they not only had the Fifth Column operating for them, and we saw people around shining lights at night and sending messages from the island to Kowloon across the water, but during the day they'd got good trained glasses. They installed batteries around Kowloon in the various go-downs and wharfs on Kowloon Harbour Front. You'd see the doors opened and out, put a field gun and bang, 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 and then shut the doors again. You must remember that our guns were pointing the other way, seaward, and there were very few guns trained onto Kowloon itself. So there was not much we could do. And it was constant artillery bombardment from the back door. We had no air force to support us. We had built up as the RAF Sumter, which were bombed on day one. The Japanese at any one time had 60 planes up in the air, bombers, fighters and what have you, operating from a very near air base at Canton.
What sort of damage did you see done during that period?
Buildings, there were targets up on all along the peak, because I wasn't able to go back into Hong Kong itself. There was damage all the way along the peak where they picked off rather large houses and establishments and barracks and what have you. That was the damage, yes.
What sort of conditions were you operating in?
By conditions, you mean during the night or
what? Well, what sort of terrain were you working in?
Mountainous area on top of the mountains, the ridge of Hong Kong itself. That was dry enough, but it was constant shell fire, bombings, and so on. All the gaps were targets for bombing and so on. And of course, we were being bombed and shelled all the time. Every gap would be shelled constantly for a period of day. And that's where our cables were destroyed, and we had to go out and repair them. It's no fun sitting there repairing cables with shells battering around you.
Did you lose many men?
We lost 17 men in all.
What were you doing when news of the surrender came through?
We had retreated to Victoria Peak, by the Peak Tram, and we were in a rather large residential establishment there, waiting orders, next orders to take up a new post and so on, when an officer appeared and said that a surrender had been agreed and that we were now, we would have to wait until a Japanese contingent appeared and we would have to surrender ourselves to the Japanese. And we had to hand all our weapons in, complete, that was one of the agreements of the surrender, unconditional surrender, that the weapons weren't to be sabotaged and so on. Needless to say, we sabotaged our rifles and small arms, threw the bolts away and bits and pieces away and surrendered and put those in a pile, and then we had to wait. And that evening, about 6 o'clock, a detachment of Japanese came along the street. We had to assemble and we were marched down then into Hong Kong.
Had you had any hope up until that point of a 11th hour rescue or some sort of intervention from outside?
Yes, we had. There were reports given out, military communiques, that Chiang Kai-shek had sent an army to the Japanese rear on the Kowloon territories, and an attack was to be mounted and the relief of Hong Kong was about to start. This proved to be absolute nonsense. But it was a morale booster at the time, and I think they gave it out for that purpose.
So where were you marched to by the Japanese?
To our barracks, our previous barracks, which was Victoria Barracks in Hong Kong. And we stayed about a week. Japanese cordon was put round the barracks. We weren't allowed out. We fended for ourselves and so on. And until the Japanese High Command then decided to move us to POW cages.
What sort of discussions went on in Victoria Barracks? I mean, was there a lot of pessimism or feeling of hopelessness?
Yes, the feeling of hopelessness was the thing at that time. You didn't know what was going on, what was going to happen to you, where you were going to go, and so on.
So during the week in Victoria Barracks, you organised your own, you organised yourself as far as food and other arrangements, right?
Yes, domestically, you looked after yourselves.
When were you moved to the cages?
About 7 days after the surrender, and we had to walk then to the Star Ferry. The whole of the Hong Kong Signal Squadron walked to the Star Ferry. There met up with other contingents, engineers, ordnance and so on, and boarded the ferry across to Kowloon, and we then, the long march to Sham Shui Po, which was, I suppose, about 4 miles or something like that, marching with your bits and pieces, the ragtag army, and march into captivity.
What did Hong Kong look like?
It looked a shambles. All the electric cables were down, the tram line cables were down, being looted by the Chinese and subsequently the Japanese, and it was a complete shambles.
What sort of condition was Sham Shui Po in when you got there?
The buildings were still there, no windows, no doors, because there had been a period of time before the Japanese had before the Japanese came to Kowloon, and the disappearance of the British forces from there. So the Chinese had stripped every piece of wood, window frames, glass, systematically stripped it. So you walked into huts that had no windows, no doors, nothing, no beds. And that was your start in life. No cooking utensils, nothing.
Were you left to organise yourselves and to make your arrangements for cooking and so on, or did the Japanese organise you?
The Japanese, first of all, we made our own arrangements for about 2 or 3 days, and then the Japanese brought in some oil drums and gave us some chisels, and they told us to cut the oil drums in half and boil out the drums, and these were then our cooking pots. And so the rice, as you can imagine, tasted of oil for about 2 or 3 weeks. They then told us how to make rice, how to cook it, rather. They threw in a few vegetables, nothing else than that. Vegetables and rice.
So when you first started cooking rice, it was pretty horrible, was it?
Terrible. Terrible. Like glue.
How was discipline administered?
Within the British Army, normal British Army discipline, which was quite good, and saved the day for us. I've seen discipline of other nations had to of prisoners of war, and it's not good. It goes to rock bottom, and I won't specify any other nationalities. But the British morale was very, very good because of its discipline.
Were there other nationalities in Shamshupo?
The volunteers were there, some of the volunteers. No. Canadians, yes. But then they weeded the Canadians out, took them off somewhere, and so on. So you were finally left with Shamshupo as a British camp.
Did anyone attempt to escape?
Yes. Yes. Initially, one or two tried to escape. They then put wire around the camp and then electrified that. If they caught anyone, we had our tenko, night and morning tenko is a roll call, and you all paraded at 7 o'clock in the morning and then in the evening at 6, and the last escapee was brought in dead and paraded before you, and that was an object. Don't attempt it. We were then warned, because there were one or two escapes, and it was difficult. How do you escape from China? How do you escape a white face amongst those people and go through the Japanese lines for about 300 miles undetected? You've got the China Seas and the Pacific the other side. What chance of escape have you? It's not rather like a European, it's not a European theatre. But to stop further escapes, the Japanese ordered that all the men would be grouped, all the soldiers and officers would be grouped in fives, and if any one of the five or two of the five escaped, the other three would be shot constantly from then on, watching where your friends were.
Did that lead to a certain amount of mutual distrust, or did it work well on the whole?
It worked well, really, because you said to people, look here, if you're going to escape, and if it was three out of the five that wanted to escape, then all right, you had to go with it. But, as I say, your chances of escape were so difficult.
Did people try to escape once that system had been instituted?
No. No, it called a halt to it.
Were there any members of the British Army or of the Canadian Army who were sort of over-friendly with the Japanese in the opinion of our soldiers?
Shall I say cooperation, or who cooperated with them rather than over-friendly? There was a case, and indeed an officer, Major Boone, was court-martialed after the war. And who was exonerated of all charges. Yes, there was a certain cell in Hong Kong that who had the administrative responsibility for the camp. We thought that they had rather cooperated, but we don't know the pressures that they were put under. And indeed, this proved so after the war when Major Boone was exonerated.
Did you have to do any work?
In Hong Kong, the work was going out on working parties to free and speak, easy access over the areas that were, that we had blown up. In other words, the passes that the Japanese had come through, they'd been blown, and we had to clear those. And also extending the Kaitak airport to allow for Japanese bombers to land there and so on. Yes, but that's the sort of work we did.
Were you paid for the work?
Not in Hong Kong. But later on, when we went off to Japan, we received the princely sum of 3 halfpence a day, the equivalent of 3 halfpence a day for working.
Did the officers work?
Not in Hong Kong, nor in Japan.
Did they receive any perks?
Not perks, they received a payment of 60 yen a month.
That was in Japan?
In Japan, yes.
Was there much illness in Shamshupo?
Yes, there was. The camp, as you can imagine, a lot of men put together like that with no proper cooking facilities and the poor diet, this is a rice diet, nothing more than vegetables and rice. The physical side of the camp went down exceedingly fast, and the camp then had diphtheria, dysentery, it was rife, diphtheria, dysentery, and they divided the camp in quarter sections. So you had diphtheria patients in one area, dysentery in another area, and so on. And the fit, I forget now what the third quarter was, and the fit in another quarter of the camp. But there was no medicines at all to help these people.
Did you fall ill yourself?
Yes, I had dysentery in Shamshupo and diphtheria. But I was lucky, I was able to return to my unit.
How long were you out of action with those two diseases?
With those for about a matter of 5 months.
What were conditions like in the dysentery quarter and the...
Oh, terrible. There was no medicines or anything like that to help you, and you just assisted each other and looked after each other's wretched conditions. You watched people die and so on. There was nothing you could do about it.
How many people died? What sort of proportion?
I would say then about 50%.
What happened to the dead?
They were taken out and buried. It was a daily ritual.
Where were they buried?
On the Shamshupo.